Hey there, and welcome to Speakeasy with Kendra Fisher. Join me each week as my guests and I take a deep dive into all of the conversations we've been taught are better left unsaid. No more silence, no more hiding. This is a safe space where anything goes. This week, I'm joined by Dr. Russell Kennedy. Known as the anxiety MD and author of Anxiety RX, this is somebody I've been waiting to speak to for a long time. Good day, Dr. Russell Kennedy. This is the most beautiful part about having my own podcast, is that sometimes I get to schedule guests that are entirely feeling like they might be self-serving because I have wanted to talk to you for a long time. Thank you so much for joining me here today.
Of course, Kendra.
And now maybe better known as the anxiety doctor.
The anxiety MD, actually.
The anxiety MD.
Because there's another person, it's Instagram, so you always have to get the exact letters right.
Fair.
It's like a combination lock on a safe. So it's the anxiety MD.
So anybody who's looking afterwards, after this episode, the anxiety MD is where you want to go. Again, I want to dive right in.
Let's
we were just having a quick chat before we started here, and we were comparing notes on our podcast experience and the fact that we have failed to need to be edited to this point. So we're going to see how much we can get ourselves into trouble here without edits.
All right, let's go for this.
As he pulls out his Mickey Mouse cup, my mug game is subpar today.
We'll
just compare my blend here. We're good. So anyways, first off, again, thank you so much for joining me here today. I want to know everything about you that helped you to arrive at everything you know, and I want you to teach me every bit of it.
Okay, well, we got 4 minutes. Let's do that.
But first off, just tell us a bit about yourself. How did you get into this? When I read your bio, I'm like, okay, this the progression, there's got to be a story behind comedian, doctor, anxiety, like...
Sure.
How do we cover it all?
Well, I grew up with a father who was schizophrenic and bipolar. So I think most of my early life was spent in deep paranoia that I was going to develop his mental illness. So that's why I think I developed an anxiety disorder. Okay. And my dad was never abusive or violent. He was actually very loving, playful, really intelligent guy. But after a while, I couldn't really trust the safety of him. My mother was pretty steady. She was a registered nurse from Glasgow, and she from British parents, they don't tell you they love you. They expect you just to know it because there's food on the table and a roof over your head. Okay. So she wasn't all that affectionate because she didn't get that in her family. So I kind of got starved for attention because I was a really sensitive kid. My brother's not as sensitive as I am. So I always say, you know, if you're born sensitive, which a lot of us are, like if you ask a mother, which of your kids is the most sensitive, immediately mm-hmm. she'll point to the one that's the most sensitive, right? Mm-hmm. So I was this sensitive kid. And I think, you know, if you're sensitive and you're born into a family that's loving and caring and attached, you're fine. If you're sensitive and you're born into a family with, you know, a bipolar dad, it's a bit of a sticky wicket, as they say. You know, mm-hmm. so that's, I think, what really prompted me. And I think when I was younger, I thought, okay, well, if I can become a doctor, if I can put myself through the crucible of medical school and that's and make it through, that will convince me that I'm not schizophrenic or bipolar, because usually this stuff will show up by 25. So at 25, didn't have it. I was like, okay, let's wait till 30. At 30, I didn't have it. Still like, okay, let's wait till 35. At 35, I was kind of like, okay, I guess I dodged that bullet. But you know, I developed an anxiety disorder worrying about it. So
you put in enough work
the
rest.
I got hit by another shot, but I dodged the first bullet.
Okay. So here we are now. We've gone through med school, and what was your focus? I mean, did you go in there thinking, okay, I'm going to prepare myself to treat myself and all of the illnesses I'm foreshadowing?
Kind of. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Well, I have health anxiety too, right? So you know, most people with health anxiety are amateurs. They worry about like cancer or, you know, like that sort of stuff. Easy stuff.
I feel attacked. You know?
Yeah. For me, it's like, lupus, the most complicated diseases in the world that you could possibly, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. I had that for a long time. I'm the only living survivor of that. There's a lot of things that I had because I just got more complicated diseases as I learned more about them. So yeah, having health anxiety as a medical doctor is not the joyride you might think it is.
I mean, there's so many facets to that. I would love to just sure. tear apart because I am that is by far my anxiety. I mean, when I finally started doing the work and we look at my diagnosis and, you know, it's generalized anxiety, severe panic, I've got phobias, I've got OCD, I've got, yeah. I've got the labels down.
I hear you, sister.
But I mean, sadly, I feel like an underachiever now that I've just been worried about cancer my whole life and none of the really,
you got to go for the
stuff.
Neurological diseases, Kendra, like they're the brutal one. I don't know why anyone wants to be a neurologist because here's your day as a neurologist. You have a horrible disease. There's nothing we can do about it. Next patient. You have a horrible disease. There's nothing we can do about it. Next patient. You have a horrible disease. We have this drug that probably won't do anything. That's your day as a neurologist.
But you can be our guinea pig and we can try.
Yeah. I mean, I think doctors really do want to help. And I think a lot of us went into medical school with that idea of helping. And one of the reasons why I got out of medicine was I was so tired, maybe consciously, of treating the symptoms and not really getting at the root cause. Like one of the things about me is that I have this really weird spidey sense. So I was talking to one of my clients, patients, whatever you want to call them, a couple of weeks ago. Mm-hmm. Actually, this is a year ago. I lied. And I said, "Who's Rose?" In the middle of the conversation, I said, "Who's Rose?" And she said, "Oh, Rose is my grandmother. Rose is the only one I ever felt really loved me." You know, like that crazy stuff happens to me all the time. So we talked about Rose for a while and how her connection with Rose, and that's how she wound up sort of healing from anxiety, is reconnecting that feeling that she had with her grandmother. So it's, you know, there's that neuroscientist doctor part of me, but there's also a real woo yoga teacher, comedian kind of, and the two sides of my brain are in constant battle with each other.
I love that you just put yoga teachers and comedians in the same box.
Yeah,
I think
because they're all
incredible.
Nuts. Well, you know, we're all. I mean, the reason why people got into yoga teaching in the first place is because they're screwed up to start with. There's very few people that got into yoga teaching. This is my opinion. That may not be accurate. Who were like mentally perfectly stable. They, you know, what it is. They found yoga. They found it really helped them. It's like, I gotta teach this freaking stuff to everybody.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm going to hide behind you saying it was your opinion.
Fine.
And hang on to that for dear life. Now you're using words that scare me. You're using words because as somebody who, I mean, albeit without any of the credentials that you have, I certainly did not go to med school or anything else, but I travel the world. I share my experience and I try to offer tidbits of experience that others may relate to and in order to help them to navigate life a little differently than they are. But you speak about curing anxiety. You speak about,
healing.
Healing from anxiety.
I don't use cure too much.
Okay. I thought you just said that was what cured her. So I thank you.
I could have. Maybe this is one of the things we have to edit out.
Here comes the edit.
Now we get the edits.
Now we did it. I wish this upon us.
No, I say heal because, you know, like I ruptured my left Achilles tendon in 2013, and that's what got me out of medicine. That was finally the straw that broke the doctor's back at that point.
Okay.
And it was like, I still have a scar there. Mm-hmm. It's healed, but there's still a remnant of it. It's not like I'm anxiety free. It's not like anybody's anxiety free.
Okay.
It's just that I recognize the anxiety as this state of alarm in my body. Mm-hmm. And I'm so familiar with it now. Like I've trained myself to be so familiar with that sensation that it doesn't bother me so much anymore. It's like the lions in South Africa when you drive by in a game vehicle, right? Yeah. Even if you've got leopard print pants on, you know, they just ignore you. You know, so it's for me, I feel the alarm in my body. I just don't start giving it a whole lot of credibility by compulsively adding thoughts to it. Because what happens is I think what you couple thinking with feeling better for like 0.4 of a second, we can talk about the dopamine structure and how that creates this addiction to worry that we have. Because I think when we worry, we appear to make the uncertain appear more certain. And in our brains, in the nucleus accumbens, in the part of our brain that is motivation and kind of helps us feel better, Mm-hmm. We get a little shot of dopamine. Oh, I made sense of that. Oh, okay. So when you make the uncertain appear more certain with worry, you get a little shot of dopamine. So mm-hmm. that's one of the reasons why a worry becomes so addictive, is because for about 0.4 of a second, you do feel slightly better. But then you worry that you have this thing or whatever you've convinced yourself of, and then it all, the whole cycle starts again. You have to keep worrying to try and recapture that feeling of 0.4 of a second of a safety forever. And the whole thing, it's like the carnival games at those, you know, midways of the car, you know, when you have to throw a ring over a Coke bottle or whatever. The only way to win that game is to not play it. So the only way to win the worry game is to not play it. But easier said than done, of course, because we've trained our brains that worry actually makes us feel better in the very, very short term. So that's why we do it. We're addicted to worry. So it's very difficult to leave something that you're addicted to, because it gives you the illusion of being safe, even if it's for less than a second at a time.
And that's it. Eh? That's all it takes for us to be hooked, to grab onto that and to want to...
Right through childhood, we basically just burn it in. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like going to the brain gym every day to worry. So we get really good at it, yeah. Right? We're Olympic. Yeah. My mother is an Olympic level worrier. I say in the book, it's like she would win the silver medal. I'd get the gold, but she'd get the silver for sure.
And this is so fascinating to me, because I'm in this place right now in my life where, I mean, I have actively lived as a high functioning sufferer mm-hmm. of anxiety for yeah. many, many years. And I've been given the gift of having my reality shattered and that whole illusion of control just absolutely robbed of me. And I'm in that place right now where I'm trying to learn how to kind of retrain that experience of how I sense anxiety and how it perpetuates in my body mm-hmm. and letting go of that need to justify it all. and instead really trying to learn how to experience it differently.
Yeah. And that's exactly right. It's like you have to learn how to experience where you feel quote unquote anxiety in your body. Because mm-hmm. I think anxiety isn't one thing. It's actually two things. It's the anxious thoughts of your mind. That's one. But it's also this state of physiological alarm that's stuck in your body.
Yeah.
And that physiological alarm cues the anxiety, cues the worries, and then the worries cue the alarm. So you get caught in this alarm anxiety cycle, alarm in the body, worries of the mind, and it just loops on itself and you can't get out of it. As Martha Beck says in her latest book, which I love, by the way, it's like a hall of mirrors. You just keep looking at a different mirror trying to get out, but you can't get out.
Yeah.
You know, the only way of doing it is close your eyes, don't look in the mirrors anymore, and just sort of try and feel your way out, even though it's going to hurt.
Yeah. And I mean, you couldn't have brought up a better source of information in this discussion. I mean, Martha Beck is, I listened to one of her podcasts recently, and I lost my father just over 6 months ago. And to one of those lovely neurological, he had dementia, Parkinson's, and it was, you're not wrong. I'm not going to pick one of those because I know better. So I'm going to stick with my baby fears.
Sure.
But she talks a lot about sitting with and learning to experience differently and not fighting those inclinations. And it just changes the entire experience around, how we're able to exist alongside and not have to fear and not have to have that response that is immediately, I'm in danger. Mm-hmm. And how do we work towards that? Because I think there's a lot of stop gaps. I think there's a lot of like symptomatically, and I'm expert at the like symptomatically.
Sure.
Like I'm really good at using physical activity to manage my anxiety. I understand sleeping well. I understand eating well. I understand the modalities of ice therapy and saunas and all of the things that support tangibly the physical symptoms of, but we can't fix ourselves at the surface level. Is that a fair statement?
So where do you feel anxiety in your body, Kendra?
You know what? I'm in this right now. And I just had a conversation with three of my service providers before I got in this call going, he's going to turn me into a puddle. My heart, I feel it in my heart. I feel it in my chest and I feel it in my throat.
Okay. And, you know, what I would do if you were kind of my client or someone I'd work with, I'd say, okay, can we go? Can I have your permission to go into it? And maybe not, you know, maybe you don't want to go into it. But the bottom line is to really get used to that sensation. Mm-hmm. So to move out of your head and move into the sensation, and it's going to be painful. It's going to be uncomfortable when you first go into it. But I also feel that that uncomfortable sensation is the younger version of you asking for the love and attention and connection now that it didn't maybe get back then. Mm-hmm. So it's up to us now to find that sensation. And through that sensation, we can connect with the younger version of ourselves. There's a part of our brain called the insula, which is very deep in the center of our brain. And it kind of like matches our mind to our body. And there's a lot of science that suggests that the insular cortex gets disrupted with PTSD, with anxiety, with childhood wounds, and we don't feel our bodies as much. So I think what happens is that we have this feeling that's stuck in our body that we don't like unconsciously. So what we do automatically is go up into our heads and start thinking, start worrying, because that distracts us temporarily from this feeling of alarm that's in our body, that's the real root cause of your anxiety. Mm-hmm. So when we try and fix the thoughts, we're just fixing a symptom. We're not really going at the root cause. Mm-hmm. So when you go at the root cause, when you start making friends with that sensation, it's uncomfortable. You don't like it. It's like the analogy that I draw is kind of like cold plunges. I don't know if you've ever done cold plunges before.
I have, yes.
So basically you get in and your brain screams at you, get out of this water.
Yeah, why are
this
you
is,
here?
This is really uncomfortable. Let's not do this anymore.
Yeah.
It's the same thing with the alarm. So what it does in your body is that alarm screams at you, go into your head, because that's the only safe place that you've ever had as a child, mm-hmm. whatever. Mm-hmm. So you go into your head and start worrying, which temporarily gives you a little bit of respite from this alarm in your body. But when you do cold plunges, you teach yourself, hey, I can stay with this discomfort. I don't like it. But as an adult, you have a choice. As a child, you probably didn't have a choice. But as an adult, you have a choice to stay in this discomfort. So when we stay in the discomfort of alarm, we start learning how to acclimatize to that state of alarm. We don't like the feeling, and we feel that our brain, our mind is trying to pull us into the hall of mirrors, because that gave us some relief as a child, but it's just this never-ending perpetual circuit that we're on. Mm-hmm. So it's learning how to feel the alarm and stay with it. And sometimes we need therapists, sometimes we need someone to help us stay with that sensation.
Yeah.
But I have this mantra that I use with people, it's sensation without explanation. So you sense the alarm in your body, mm-hmm. and you stay with the sensation, even if it's uncomfortable, because then you prove to yourself, I don't like this sensation, but I can stay with it. I don't have to automatically and reflexively jump into my worries, which mm-hmm. just perpetuates the whole anxiety alarm cycle that we can never get out of. So it's learning how to sort of basically turn and face the fear directly so that it kind of has a chance to metabolize and process. Whereas if you don't, you just stay in your head forever.
And so as somebody who has worked with psychologists, psychiatrists, and every other modality that I can find, I'm mm-hmm. very interested in learning, and I am always open. I'm not always open to it, but I try to be open to it. And I think that it's, I'm so intrigued, because learning more about this almost discredits some of my own success and I love that.
Interesting.
I love it. I do love it, because to me, I mean, when I can find a problem, there's more solution to be had. And when there's more solution to be had, there's room for growth and healing. And I'm here for that. So, you know, when it comes to anxiety and when it comes to panic, I've shared the modalities and the tools and the very tangible resources that I know to share that. How do we encourage people to go beyond that? Is that all therapy based? How do we drive people to that place, or help them to understand that there is indeed a root cause?
Yeah, I think it's just learning how to go into your body as opposed to your mind when you feel anxious. Now, it's interesting because, you know, teenager anxiety is different than adult anxiety in a lot of ways. I think a lot of teen anxiety is due to having a smartphone-based, you know, childhood,
yeah.
right? And
yeah.
Jonathan Haidt talks all about that. But we adults often had some sort of initiating event. They call them ACEs, you know, adverse childhood experiences, all this kind of stuff. There's other ways that we can get alarm into our body. One's my friend Mark Willen wrote a book called It Didn't Start With You about inherited family trauma. Okay. How it just sort of comes in. The other time people will come up to me and they'll say, look, my parents were great. I had a great childhood. Yeah. I was connected. And I always ask them, did you have a separation from your mother or your father before the age of 5 years old? Because 80% of your brain development's before the age of five. Mm-hmm. So often they'll come back and they'll say, oh, I asked my mom, she was in the hospital for like with a gallbladder thing after I was born for like 6 weeks. So it's like, you know what, that may not be it. But when you look at like really good parents who are there mm-hmm. for their kids, mm-hmm. often there's an inherited component to it. Often there's a feeling of being separate from their parent mm-hmm. because, you know, I learned this from my mentor in developmental psychology. All anxiety is separation anxiety. It's all separation anxiety. And I add to that, and it's mostly separation from yourself. It's mostly separation from the younger version of you that experienced, you know, what I call alarms, abuse, loss, abandonment, rejection, bullying, anything that made you mature too early, shame. All this stuff stunts our growth and locks us in this protective position.
Yeah.
And that protective position is safeguarded in a way by our minds. So we go up into our head because we learn that we get this little shot of dopamine when we worry. And it's as a child, if that's the only thing that you have, that's what you're going to double down on. And then we learn as children to go to the brain gym and worry every day. Mm-hmm. So that groove gets mm-hmm. put in us pretty deep. So when I tell people that we've got to move away from worrying, they freak out because worrying is what their ego has used to keep them safe. And I put safe in quotation marks for their whole life. Mm-hmm. So when you start going into your body, when you start actually getting at the root cause of this, your mind will scream at you to come back into the hall of mirrors. And a lot of times you will, because it was the only thing that worked as a child. But the thing is, we have to persevere with it, because if we don't persevere with it and go at the actual state of the root cause of it, which is the alarm that's stuck in your body, typically from unresolved wounding when you were younger, if we don't get at the root cause of it, you're going to be chasing therapy forever.
So, I mean, this brings on so many different ways that I could take this, but I have to ask this one as a quick interjection. As a parent, I'm hearing this and I'm like, oh my goodness. How many times have I created separation with my children, or how many times have I been in a situation where I can recognize I have a 5-year-old who was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes as a 2-year-old in the midst of a COVID pandemic. I have... Yeah. An 8-year-old who lost his baby brother knowingly as he's turning 3. Like, it just, so, you know, how do we support that then? How do we support that knowing that those exist in their childhood already? I can identify it.
Yeah. And it really, like, I think a lot of what we aren't doing enough with our kids is using their social engagement system. So Dan Siegel talks about this: eye contact, tone of voice, prosody of voice, which is the lilting quality of voice, mm-hmm. Facial expressions, body language. And for us anxiety people, Kendra, it's hard because that social engagement system was shut down in us. Mm-hmm. So I have tons of people that will say, you know, my boyfriend doesn't understand my anxiety. My girlfriend doesn't understand my anxiety, you know, because it shuts off our ability to be connected with the people that are close to us.
Yeah.
So often that draws their own anxiety. It's not really our fault in a way, because in a way we can't help it, but it does create a lot of problems in relationships when you can't do that warm eye contact, facial expression, you know, body language, tone of voice, because it gets shut down. And then we as human beings, our unconscious nature will pick up the anxiety. I know my daughter picked up my anxiety. For sure. Mm-hmm. Not as badly as I had it, but she certainly mm-hmm. picked it up. I tried to hide it from her, but there's only so much you can do.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, on that point, I've always been amused, because when I became a parent, being so aware of my own anxiety and how intently it shows up, one of those instances being I'm very phobic of vomiting. I'm emetophobic.
Mm, right.
And, you know, with the health-based anxiety, this is something that was always... ingrained in me. And I mean, so coming into a point where I'm having kids, I'm like, this is not going to go well. And of course, both my boys had reflux. So, I mean, exposure therapy at its best.
Yeah, yeah. But, or worst.
Yeah, you take your pick, depending on the day, really. But I noticed as I started parenting how much we use fear to create a positive outcome for us as parents in our children's behavior, whether it's don't do that, you're going to get hurt. Don't do that, it's going to make you sick. You should be scared of the dark. You should, you know, we read children's books and it's just like this image after image and suggestion after suggestion of what we should be scared of.
Yeah.
And so every one of those is having an impact on children.
Yeah. And I think it's up to us to start creating that place of safety for the kids. You know, we are going to shut off. I mean, the anxiety is going to come up. Our alarm is going to come up. It is going to shut off our social engagement network, but we can actually make a conscious choice. I'm going to go up and give my kid a hug, regardless of this. I'm going to rub their back. I'm going to come connected, which ironically actually helps you too, right? Because there is a resistance. We definitely have a resistance to connection when we're anxious.
Yeah.
It's like that's where social anxiety comes from, is that we shut off our social engagement system when we've got all these physiological stress chemicals in our body, adrenaline, noradrenaline, you know, cortisol, to some extent, you know, oxytocin and vasopressin, even though they're supposed to be like good hormones, can actually magnify things, magnify that need for separation. So when we feel separate, there's a part of us that feels safer. So unfortunately, that's how our kids often pick it up, is because they feel we have separated from them. But really, we've separated from ourselves first. And then it's trying to make that connection again. So how we heal that is we make the connection with ourselves first, bring back online our own social engagement system, and then we can kind of go to our kids. But like I said, you know, I'll just contradict what I just said. You can go up to your kids and give them a hug, and that hug, or if you have pets, same thing. Like you go up and you pet your pet. And you show them that love, you show them that, because so much of anxiety is basically blocking love. Like that's why we have anxiety. There is only love and fear in the world, in the universe. So as soon as we block love, the only thing left to fill us up is fear.
Wow.
And the only way to heal that is to start connecting, reconnecting with love, compassion, connection with yourself. But when our social engagement system has been shut off, we can't connect with love. So it becomes this vicious cycle that just creates this anxiety monster in all of us, because the love that we need the most is what we restrict from ourselves the most.
And can that change? Can we change that response?
Yeah. And I think we use like unconscious means as well. Like I have these hypno meditations that I give to my clients and my patients. Mm-hmm. About how I put them in a relaxed state. It's like a hypnotic induction, but it's also connecting with the younger version of themselves. And sometimes I'll say, you know, can you see your child's eyes? Can you give them the connection? I have this acronym I call SHOULD, which is basically see them, hear them, open to them, understand them, love them, and defend them. So that's what you have to do with your own child, for sure, as well as your, you know, external children. So this is what you should have got when you were younger. You should have been seen. You should have been heard. You should have been open to. You should have been understood, loved, and defended. That's what you should have got. So when you can give that to yourself now, you can start healing the root cause of what's causing this alarm, because the alarm is basically just a beaconing cry from the younger version of you asking for the love and attention now that it didn't get back then. That was a big one. You can wait for that.
No, you know what? Like nothing happens by accident. And I know we tried to have this conversation prior to, and our schedules didn't allow for it. And here we are. And there's a reason that this conversation is happening in my life right now, as far as I'm concerned. And I want to say giddy. Like I'm giddy because I'm hopeful at the fact that there's the ability for growth and change and for those experiences to be different. And I'm in the midst of that. Right. In a very beautiful way right now. I mean, my last year undid me in a way that forced me to recognize just dumping myself harder and faster into the tangible solutions and tangible tools that I did have wasn't going to suffice. Right. I wasn't getting through it. It wasn't going to carry me far enough this time for me to be able to feel as though I was safe. And I feel like that's such a huge part of it. And, you know, it's establishing that safety, I think, that is what a lot of us are seeking in that. And how do we do that, though, when our default is to go to worry, when our default and what we perceive as what feels safer to us, by what I'm understanding, is in fact the opposite of safety? How do we then start to open ourselves to the possibility of truly understanding what safety means?
Yeah, it's a great question. Have you heard of a therapy called somatic experiencing therapy?
I'm in the midst of it now.
Okay. So I'm trained in that, as well as a few other different modalities. And what we do in SE is the first thing we do with people is try to establish this groundwork of safety with them. So people will come in and say, you know, my kid is sick, or my husband's driving me nuts, or whatever it is. And a lot of therapists will say, okay, well, tell me about this. Tell me about what the troubles are. And in SE, what we typically try and do is create a sense of safety in the body first before we start going into the, you know, collateral cognitive explanations that we have. Because unless you ground something in the body first, it has nowhere to stick. And this is kind of my issue with cognitive talk therapy, is that unless you create a safe place in the body first, those tactics tend to wear off, because that ego of pulling you back into the hall of mirrors is so powerful that just having a cognitive sort of tool to help you escape from it is not going to work. And here's another reason why it doesn't work. So when we get into survival physiology, which you know well, I know well, we create cortisol, epinephrine in our system. And unfortunately, those things shut off the part of the brain that's cognitive. So cognitive therapies will often leave us when we need them the most. Because the cognitive part of our brain that will go, hey, you know what? This isn't a big deal. This is not, you know, this is not real, whatever it is. That part of your brain shut off. So you're not, and not only is it shut off, you have directed the needle towards anything that is scary. So your body will direct the needle of your mind. So if your body is feeling tense and anxious and alarmed, as I call it, it will direct attention to all of the things that are happening in your life that are scaring the crap out of you. And I love the David Goggins quote where he says, the mind has a tactical advantage over you, which it does.
Yes, it does.
So it knows all your worst points, and it will suck you into those worst points, because when you were a child, worry did give you a temporary sense of relief. So what we have to do is find that safety in the body. And we do that by sometimes putting people like on a massage table and putting our hands underneath, you know, their back or their shoulders or their neck. You know, sometimes I get people to put their hand behind their neck like this. And it's incredibly reassuring for people. It's almost like when we cradle a baby's head. It's so reassuring for people. So it's my whole thing is, we have to start with the body, and the body is a much more efficient way of healing the mind than the mind is for healing the body. And so we have to start with the body first, create that sense of safety in the body, which many of us have never had. So, and then there's things like parts work, you know, IFS, great. It's a great modality as well. And it goes sort of contrary to the traditional kind of, oh, just talk about your issues and it will, you know, it will resolve them. And that clearly, you know, we've had 100 years of doing that, hasn't really worked.
And it's, I mean, I'm fascinated because I'm in that transition right now and I love it. Like I'm I have no problems with finding out there's better ways. and I'm in it right now because I'm somebody who, I was introduced to talk therapy. I was introduced to CBT. I was introduced to, you know, really trying to discover
EMDR, all those things.
Absolutely.
And all
have value. I'm absolutely not discrediting. I have certainly found my way into understanding things better through talk therapy, but now I'm left with the realization that it's that whole kind of body up approach that I need to learn now.
Right.
because I have the ability to, I can think about anything. I could talk about anything. I can conceptualize it. I can see it. I can make sense of it. I could put it into practice, but it's that sticking, like you said, it's that having nowhere foundationally for it to exist beyond my comprehension. And I can intellectualize it till I'm blue in the face, but it kind of aligns with the whole thought for me and that idea between, you know, parasympathetic, sympathetic, and how we are able to actually connect with the ability to be rational and the ability to problem solve. And it's gone when you're in that state.
Totally. You know, and you can learn how to bring it back. One of the ways you can bring it back is play. You know, Martha talks about that, Martha Beck, in her latest book, about how important play is, how important that right hemisphere, you know, you hit the wall with left hemisphere thinking. Clearly you're intelligent. Clearly you've been through a lot of the cognitive type therapies, and they do help. There's no two ways around that. They help you cope, but I don't believe they really help you heal.
Yeah.
And I think to heal, we have to go at this from a body-based direction rather than an issue-based direction. If we're focused on the issue, like I have anxiety or this is wrong with my life or whatever it is, you know, healing the external features is like giving people a medication in medicine, which is what I used to do all the time. You know, reflux, I would give people a proton pump inhibitor and that would fix their reflux for sure. But it creates all sorts of other problems, right? Yeah. So body-based therapy first allows you, and believe me, I'm a medical doctor and a neuroscientist, so I want to have a seizure sometimes when I talk about this because it sounds so woo. But it's the only thing that helped me after like 40 years.
Yeah.
And Martha's book's great because it sort of allows you to kind of, it gives you permission to go get out of the hall of mirrors and move into that creative part of you and do it more often so that you actually do have something that works that is healthy and productive as opposed to worry.
Mm-hmm.
Because worry does work. Worry, people say worry does nothing. It's like, no, worry actually makes you feel better in the very short term. For those of us who had horrible uncertainty as children, when you find a little method that makes the uncertain appear more certain, which is exactly what worry does, we grab onto that forever. And then if you're smart, and this is, Mel Robbins is like this too. Mel Robbins uses a lot of her accomplishments to outrun her anxiety. And after a while, you know, it doesn't quite work anymore, you know? And Mel's been amazing. Like Mel's been like probably the biggest champion of my work is Mel. I just love Mel Robbins so much. And I think it's really important to understand that we can use intellectual strategies to accomplish, to appear to get ahead.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, the smarter you are, the more likely you're going to follow that intellectual path because it does appear to work, but it takes you in the wrong direction.
Yeah.
Like the smarter you are, this is the thing about anxiety. A lot of people with anxiety are really smart people. And unfortunately, that works against us in a lot of ways because we start believing that our cognitive mind can fix it when it can't. The opposite of that fixes it. The going into your body, going into the feeling state, which is exactly what we avoid as intellectuals, is the feeling state.
It's funny. I'm laughing mostly because, again, I told you I was going to feel called out on this conversation, and I, in the most loving and supportive way, because it's just it's an acceptance of the truth, right? I can rationalize anything, and very similarly to Mel Robbins' approach, I'm somebody who very much has relied on, you know, I'm a great athlete. I can be a great athlete.
Sure.
I can get up on a stage in front of thousands of people, and I can motivate them, and I can help them. But when it came to just sitting with myself, and this is where the last couple of months sat me on my ass, was just sitting with myself and recognizing the depth of the pain that was inside of me that I was still trying to outrun and justifying outrunning it because I was using acceptable tactics to outrun it. It's not bad if I'm just working out really hard. It's not bad if I'm just, you know, pouring myself into work or pouring myself into being successful or pouring myself into these things and allowing that to give me enough gratification that I could survive that discomfort. And, you know, just kind of a really polarizing year of loss put me in a place to realize I don't want to just survive my life. I would like to be at peace. I would like to find ease. I would like to enjoy it in a way that allows me to connect to being present. And I realized the absence of that. And it was entirely just ingrained in the chaos that my anxiety creates for me and that I hold on to with both hands.
Well, it works, Kendra. The anxiety works. It pulls you away from that pain that's stuck in your body, from the younger version of you. So it does work from a neurological point of view. Mm-hmm. It eases the pain in the short term. And if that's all you've got, and as children, that was all we had. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, we ride that thing until the wheels fall off.
Yeah,
so, you know, we're now 30, 40, 50, 60 years old, and we're still riding the worry train thinking that eventually it's going to come to the station of peace. Mm-hmm. And it's not. Mm-mm. It ain't going to do that.
No, it's the whole, I always say when I'm speaking, we don't try to teach people to swim when they're drowning. Yeah. And instead, we try to learn those tools when we're feeling like we're on solid ground. The problem is if you never allow yourself to be on solid ground or learn actually what solid ground feels like, it's a constant journey of seeking and one that has no ending.
Right. And this is one of the things that I used to have against antidepressants. I have nothing against psych meds, by the way. I think psych meds are freaking amazing. We need them in our lives.
Yeah.
But when people feel better, they don't feel any desire at all to work on the underlying problem, right?
Yeah.
So that's the thing. That's the time where you would get the most traction.
Yeah.
But the time that people will want to work on their issues is when they're most debilitated by their issues, right? And that's one of the human condition that just kills us.
Yeah.
You know, and that's one of the things that I wasn't that crazy about with antidepressants was that when people would feel better and I would see them and I'd say, you know, you probably could work through this.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like it's, you know, emotional, physical, sexual abuse, like major stuff that you know, we need help on. Mm-hmm. You know, you could probably work yourself through this. But once they felt better, you know, and here's my other thing with antidepressants. Let me finish that. Once they felt better, there was no need to actually go at the root cause of the problem.
Yeah.
So when you don't feel the pain, you're like, hey, I don't have the pain anymore. It's like, it's gone. It's not coming back, but it always comes back. It's like the cat.
It's so fun. It's so fun. And it's that's been the constant. I mean, that's been the roller coaster of my life is that very much it comes back and then I throw every tool I've got at it.
Right.
And I manage it. I'm not healing from it. I'm not growing. I'm not moving past, but I can manage. I can tolerate. I can get myself back into a place where I can very functionally live with my anxiety and just kind of keep going until I feel well enough that it's a plateau I'll accept.
Right.
And once we accept that plateau, then it's that, okay, I'm just going to cruise on this until I find out that my complacency and not going at the root cause is going to end me right back where I am again.
Well, it works for you,
mm-hmm.
you know, Kendra. I mean, it works for all of us. The worry does appear in our brains to work. It's a familiar place. It's like that t-shirt that says, I'm in my own little world, but it's okay. They know me here.
Yeah. That's fair.
Right.
I like that.
So that anxious state is very familiar. And in that familiarity, there's a sense of security in that.
Mm-hmm.
So there's much more security in the familiarity of pain than there is in the unfamiliarity of being safe. And in fact, I have so many people that I've treated over the years that say, I feel worried when I'm not worrying. Because that ego dragon, I call this thing the ego dragon, which is basically this big omnipotent, incredibly strong figure we invented when we were children, but it's very dumb. Like the ego dragon says, if anything hurt you, you will never do that again. I will go into your body and I will make sure that you will never do that again.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you're at show and tell and you drop something and the class laughs at you, it's like, we are never speaking in front of people ever again. And when you try, your body goes into this five alarm fire and you can't do it, or doing it is incredibly difficult. And I often get people to actually use the word alarm instead of anxiety. So instead of saying my anxiety, I say my alarm, because words have consciousness to them.
Absolutely.
And I think alarm has a lot more consciousness than anxiety. Anxiety is this very nebulous word. The only thing I like about the word anxiety is that if you rearrange the letters, you get any exit, which I thought was is amazing. Yeah. But yeah, exactly. But it's really about, and I think that if you address it as it is, I think we start to get closer to the consciousness of it. So it's really a state of alarm, you know, kind of. I would encourage you to say my alarm instead of my anxiety.
I like
that. And just that one little change sometimes makes a difference.
Yeah. Now moving past that, so you know, I've listened to you talk and I agree. And again, like I said, I'm facing it head on right now, happily. Once you get back to that place, you start to get to a place where you can find the root. Now, and I get that I'm trying to condense a lot into a little here. So bear with me, because I recognize there would be a lot greater process to this than the simplicity of which I'm explaining it right now. But so let's say you journey inward, which is where I'm at, and you can actually identify that root cause. You can find moments in your childhood. You can find moments of separation or pain or trauma that viscerally you can feel the connect to. Then what? You know, you identify this, then what?
Yeah.
It's there. And it's just like, okay, well,
then you focus on it. Then you feel it. Like, so you said your throat, your heart, mm-hmm. you know, I would get, this is what I get people to do. It's like, okay, how deep is it? Does it have a temperature? Does it have a color? Does it have a shape? Does it have mm-hmm. a size? Where is it? Is it stronger at some points than others? Does it have a texture? Like, we really go into, and this is the insular cortex again. This is what I was talking about, how the brain makes a body-based representation of the alarm. Because what I feel happens when we're younger is that we get into a situation, there is too much pain for us or for our little minds to bear. Mm-hmm. And if we don't have parents or caregivers to help us repair that, mm-hmm. basically it gets repressed, suppressed, whatever Freudian term you want to use, into your body. Mm-hmm. And that's where it gets offloaded so that we can actually function as children. Mm-hmm. Now, that pain is still there, and we can actually use that pain as a way of really just drilling down into it. So I say, is it a pressure? Is it a pain? Where is it? Does it have a color? Does it have a temperature? And again, I know it sounds woo, but when we get into this, sometimes sensations, emotions, images, memories, these things will come back as we go into that. Now, if we are safe, if we have an environment where we're safe, we're with a therapist or we're safe, we can go into that. We can dip our toe in that. Mm-hmm. And we can also come out as well, which often what happens is we get sucked so deep into that pain vortex that we don't realize that we can come back out again. Mm-hmm. So it's really about titrating, going back and forth, going into that. You know, say you were, just for example, you were hit by one of your parents. Say, let's say your mother. So it's that we go into that feeling, that sensation of being hit by your mother. Mm-hmm. And it's like, okay, well, let's come out of it. Like, sometimes what I'll do when I work with people is I'll say, what was the very best time in your life? Mm-hmm. So what was the best time in your life, Kendra? Do you remember? Like, or one time that was just amazing?
Yeah. So doing, again, because I'm very much engaged in this right now, one of the references that I have to that is just spending time on the beach in Kincardine with my parents. And it's very much that. It's a place where I feel safe, I feel peaceful, and I can really connect to that sense of knowing that sense of just there's not, it doesn't associate with any negative emotion in my body.
And is there a place where that kind of lights up in your body? Like, if you really focus on being there on that beach, is there a place in your body that you...
Yeah, in my chest, I can feel that. I can feel, it feels warm, it feels peaceful. I often, when I was asked to explore this, it was very much the colors of like the sun, like the yellows and the oranges and the, it's a very light feeling, and it's something that feels warm and it feels comforting.
So what I often do, it's like, okay, now where is the, now we're speeding this up 100%, considerably, right?
100%.
So that place you said in your heart, mm-hmm. that where you get anxious or you get mm-hmm. alarmed, I probably should say. What does that feel like?
Fear. It's a lot of fear, a lot of empty and dark. It's a very heavy feeling, and it feels suffocating. It feels very pitted. And as I start to focus on it, I can often feel it dropping down. That weight feels like it's dropping into the top of my abdomen as well. Mm-hmm. And it feels very... unsure. Like it's very much that desperate feeling of looking for something to find a way out of it.
How old are you?
I'm 4 or 5.
Okay. So then what I would do is we'd go back and forth between being on the beach in Concarden, mm-hmm. and that warm kind of yellow light comfort. Mm-hmm. And then we go dip our toe back into the empty, hollow, pitted mm-hmm. place. Now, again, we are speeding this up 1,000 times.
Absolutely.
So you get a felt sense that, hey, this pain is uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. But it's not all of me.
Yeah.
Because as a child, when we have those pains in our body, it feels like all of us. It yeah. feels like there is no way out. There is nothing else other than that pain. It's yeah. all encompassing. It's all we see. It's all we feel. What I'm trying to show your unconscious mind is that no, it's not all encompassing. Mm-hmm. It's not this big wall where you can only see this. Yeah. We can transport you back into a place of comfort as well. Mm-hmm. And we go back and forth between the two. And then eventually, this is just one aspect. Yeah, I mean, there's a number of different ways that I deal with people's yeah. alarm.
Yeah.
But it's also, you know, talking to that younger version of you saying, I know this feels hollow and pitted, you know, and then, you know, closing your eyes and say, is there anything you want to say to me? Like, is that pitted part of you associated with any particular event that you feel okay sharing?
Yeah. And my health related issues. So when I was young, I was diagnosed with an illness. I don't mind sharing. It's lichen sclerosis. And so the investigation for lichen sclerosis when I was diagnosed with it was very young. I was, mm-hmm. I was 2 when I was diagnosed, and that's a very intrusive, examination for those who don't know. It involves the genital area. So it was something that oftentimes I felt unsafe and I felt unseen and I felt very scared and unaware of what was happening because it was also a painful condition.
Sure.
And on a couple of occasions, I was forced to undergo medical procedures for biopsy issues and such. And this is back in a time when they didn't let your parents stay at
right.
the hospital.
Yeah.
So I was very much alone and I was very afraid. And so everything in the instance of that and everything surrounding that experience growing up for me was very isolating. Mm-hmm. And I was very fearful I'd be alone with it. And I'm in this process now. So very much getting to the root of meeting this girl where she's at.
Yeah.
And beautifully. I mean, I'm torn between wanting to laugh and cry.
Sure.
Because I can recognize and offer my adult perspective now to being able to provide safety to this younger child. But in recognizing how deeply rooted that sadness and that fear is, it's so beautiful and empowering now.
And that's why we often feel what appears to be conflicting emotions by mm-hmm. our cognitive mind, like laughing and crying. They're not that far apart physiologically, actually. But people will say, like, I'll get people to look at their alarm. It's like it feels both boiling hot and icy cold at the exact same time. And it's like, yeah, because we're dealing with your unconscious mind. We're dealing with that sort of right-brained kind of thing. I remember when Jill Bolte Taylor talked about her stroke of insight, how her left hemisphere was completely impaired. And when her left hemisphere went offline, she looked at her hand and it was just this ball of energy.
Yeah.
You know, and with the tiles of the
shower
yeah. behind it, you know, and basically that's where we're getting, because it there is no cognitive left hemispheric reduction of experience there. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what I would do is I have this little process with people I call commiserating, which is like when you're calm and you've settled yourself in your body, like sometimes I'll do it through hypnosis. It's like, can you say to that little girl, you know, it must have been really hard for you going through that pain or going through that feeling like all these people are looking at you and that kind of thing. And then just wait and see if anything comes back. And what I do notice with people is that they may have to ask this question for months before they ask the kid. Because here's what I call anxiety. Anxiety is basically a separation of your adult self from your child self and your mind from your body. Right. So the more you can do to bring your adult self and child self back together and your mind and your body back together, the more you heal that alarm. And the alarm is the ultimate source of the anxiety. If the alarm is resolved, we don't need the anxiety anymore. And that's what I found. As I resolved my alarm, I noticed that I would still get worries, but they just didn't have any resonance. They just didn't have any importance behind them. So I would just be able to kind of laugh them off. You know, it's just like it didn't have any, it wasn't sucking me back into the hall of mirrors anymore. So I think, you know, I call that process commiserating. And I get that with people. It's like when you were bullied, like, how did it feel when you were bullied, you know, in Mr. Hall's classroom? Like, how did that feel to you? And just wait, you know, and just sort of see what comes up. Because as you connect that adult self with your child self, the child is asking you for attention through the alarm. That's how they're asking you for attention. And unfortunately, we push that alarm away. So we become more accomplished. We do things, we become more cognitive. And the kid gets louder, or they go into dorsal vagal shutdown and they shut off. So we'll go through periods where that alarm is there, but it just feels so numbed out that we can't access it either. So it's very nuanced, you know, dealing with people as far as their alarm goes. But this is the only type of therapy or the only type of intervention for me that's ever made any difference at all is this sort of body-based, grounded in safety, finding the younger version of you and then trying to heal it. And what I was talking about earlier on with the kids and their phone-based childhood, it's a different type of anxiety for them. It's separation, because all anxiety is separation, but it's a different type of separation for them. They didn't really learn that social engagement system. So when we were younger and we would play in the playground and we would see one of our friends fall and cry, like we would process all that stuff. But kids aren't getting that social engagement system anymore. They're not getting the eye contact, tone of voice, prosody voice, body language, facial expression. They're not getting that. So that part of their brain hasn't matured. So of course they're going to be anxious.
And so how do we affect change on that? How do we affect change on that in a way, understanding, and I believe this to be true, that we're not going to make phones disappear. We're not going to make social media disappear. We're not moving back. There's no there's no world that exists anymore where this is not part of their reality.
Exactly.
So how do we work with that? How do we move to a place of allowing children to develop? Because it's true. I mean, the anxiety pandemic is just forever growing at this point.
Absolutely.
And so how do we affect change?
I think touch is really important for kids. You know, it's like, I think that's one of the things. And again, that social engagement system, you know, encouraging them to have safe eye contact with you just at the dinner table, just for fun, right? Or play a game with your kids at the dinner table. It's like, okay, what facial expression am I making right now? It's like, oh, you're angry. You know, like the kids are starving for this, because you don't get this through screens. You know, prosody of voice, like have fun, sing with your kids, like sing with them. Or teach them how to chant, you know, even just silly, like, om, you know, anything that activates that recurrent laryngeal nerve of the vagus. That's why singing and chanting makes us feel better, because it actually activates the recurrent laryngeal branch of the vagus nerve, sends a message back up to your brain. Hey, you're safe. Breathing, teaching your kids how to breathe properly, you know, having little breathing things with your kids every day. Showing them that it's really important to learn this skill of breathing, because when you're anxious or alarmed, the alarm is breathing you. It's breathing you to facilitate itself. So it gets high up in our chest and then it just facilitates itself. It doesn't allow you to kind of just, take
you're
that
talking
breath.
And I'm like, oh, I need a breath.
Teaching our kids to breathe properly, you know, eye contact, tone of voice, prosody of voice, body language, you know, teaching our kids that moving, dancing, you know, facial expressions, what am I doing with my face right now? And just doing that with them every single day, because they are not getting that. And on top of that, they are seduced by their screens. So they don't, in a way, they don't want it. Yeah. So it's our job as parents to kind of go, hey, screen's going to go away. We're going to play the face game for a while.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
This is what we have to do. And this is what we aren't doing, because the parents get freaked out because their kids are anxious. Parents get freaked out. They lose their social engagement system. Yeah. So it's like they're not able to model the behaviors that they need to soothe their kids.
Well, I think one of the coolest things, though, is also the fact that I think there's a lot of ignorance there. I don't think a lot of us would have any idea. And I mean, I don't think most people would have any idea that something like chanting or singing or what the impact of that is on the vagal nervous system. And like, I think that there's so many facets of that and so many levels of complexity in there that I wish more people understood for that very reason, because there's so many parts of our day-to-day lives when we were younger and what we experienced versus what experience now.
Absolutely.
That without intention supported a healthier body and mind.
Oh yeah. Like face yoga makes me want to just, you know, throw up because it sounds so woo and so out there, especially for a medical doctor, but it freaking works, man. Like it works for kids. Face yoga. Yeah. One of the most important things you can do. Here's a really interesting study that I read like about a year ago. So Hollywood actors and actresses are getting Botox, right? Mm-hmm. So they're shooting the masseter muscle. They're shooting the orbicularis oris muscle. And basically your facial muscles send a message back to your brain to how you're feeling. They did a study years ago about putting a pencil in people's mouth and then having them rate faces, and they rated them more positively when they had a pencil in their mouth. So they were actually activating the smile muscles.
Wow.
So it's one of those things that as these people lose this connection with their muscles, their acting dropped. They weren't able to feel the emotions that they needed to move through a scene anymore, because they were paralyzing the mechanism that we use, both in expressive and impressive, I guess, to feel emotion.
That's unreal. So yeah. I should be proud of all of my wrinkles.
You should.
I should embrace the hell Absolutely. Out of my emotions.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's the only way to heal.
I'm full of it. I love it. I love it. That's like the best piece of advice. I feel like that in and itself is going to be a clip that gets pinned to the top of every profile I have, just so that I can share with everybody. I am keeping my wrinkles because I was medically advised that they benefit my ability to connect to my emotions.
Totally. And your kids.
Unbelievable. I love that so much. I really do. I would like to keep you on here for hours and hours and hours, and I don't think that that would be fair of me, but I am so appreciative of your time and of your willingness to connect with me here. I love your work. I mean, I feel like we could do a part two, part three, if you're ever, you know.
Yeah, sure.
If you're ever up for it, I would absolutely love to. But thank you for everything you're doing.
You're welcome, Karen. You're welcome, Kendra. It's been a joy talking with you, because I can tell that you've really, you know, walked a mile in the shoes of anxiety. I love talking to people who have actually been in the trenches rather than people. Yeah. It's like, oh, well, we've got Dr. Kennedy on today and he's going to talk about anxiety. You know, it's like, no, I love talking to people who have actually been there, because we have a kinship. Absolutely. We know what it's like to be convince ourselves that we're dying. We are actually dying. I think I have spent a month of my life, if I accumulate those hours, in truly believing that I was dying.
Yeah.
And I'm 64 now and I'm still here.
Yep. You're right on the head. I mean, it's a connection that you don't ever want somebody else to understand, but there's also such a relief in knowing that you're not the only
everybody
person
feels it on some
who
level.
Is capable of writing their own death sentence day in and day out. Now, you might be more impressive than anybody I've ever met.
Yeah, I got the fancier diseases.
Yeah,
for sure.
only in the cause of death.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
That's wonderful. I thank you. I will bother you to join me for another conversation soon. Sure. I am so fascinated by your work. I would love the opportunity to learn more. And quite frankly, I'm not selfish enough to think that I should learn it in private, because too many people will benefit from hearing conversations like this and understanding that, you know, even when we get to a place of feeling like we are high functioning, there's so much further to go. There's so much more that is available to us if we're really, truly willing to turn inwards. And
Well, that's why I wrote the book. That's why I wrote Anxiety Rx. And basically it sold 100,000 copies as a self-published work.
Yeah.
And then Macmillan and Penguin Random House took on the second edition. And the second edition is actually quite a bit different than the first. It's about a third different. Mm-hmm. And then my online program, MBRX, I make it like $100 because it's less than the cost of one therapy session. And when you finish that program, you will know more about anxiety than most therapists do.
Amazing. I'll be sure to share that information too for people. And if, again, also all this information is available on your Instagram at anxiety.
The Anxiety MD.
The Anxiety MD. Sorry, I don't have it in front of me.
No worries. No problem, Kendra.
More interested in what you have to say than your Instagram handle.
Sure. Thank you so much, Kendra.
No, thank you. I appreciate you. Take care.
Bye.
Thanks for hanging out with us on another episode of Speakeasy, where we believe conversations are meant to be had out loud. Share this episode to help others find our show, and don't forget to rate and review on Apple Podcasts. You can also join me at kfisher30 on Instagram as I travel across Canada and the US tackling the current mental health crisis with colleges and universities.